Everybody look left. Everybody look right. Everywhere you look, I'm standing in the spotlight. Nah, yeah. You hear it in the head and on the wing. It's gonna be King Simba's mightiest fling. Whoa, I just can't wait to be king. Whoa, I just can't wait to be king. Whoa, I just can't wait.
If you can't tell, we have entered into Leo season. That's right. Get the claws out, girlies. Get the confidence up. We said shake out the mane because this gonna be insane. Not in an ableist way, but in a way that's wildly fun. I am sorry. Actually, no, I'm not apologizing. I take that apology back. I'm not sorry for nothing, at least nothing that has happened so far on this podcast. But I do want to, you know, take a step back. I'm just giving you energy boots. And I'm like, do you even know what's going on? So, hey, hi, you're listening to Zabuma Foolish with me, your host, Jay. I use the pronouns they, them, and today we're going to be talking about some exciting amphibians, some wild situations happening in Stanley Park, and we're going to kind of wrap it all, tap it all together with some glowy-owy magic moments. Now, if none of that made sense to you, well, strap your strap on and get ready for a wild time, because this bussy about to be bussing. Okay, let's get into the episode.
Zabuma foolish, Zabuma foolish,
Y'all know Dora when she's like, grab your backpacks, let's go, jump in, vamanos. I was so close at the start of this episode to be like, grab your strap-ons, let's go, strap up, vamanos. But I was like, oof, I like literally advertise this to children. But you know what, kids, listen to this podcast, you can be sex positive or be sexually curious and not feel weird about it. Like, don't develop a complex about it. Like, people have sex, adults have sex, you know, so you're gonna have sex eventually if you're listening to this, and maybe you already are having sex and you're like, oh my god, I feel weird because no one in my life likes to talk about it. Girl, get you some friends that like to talk about sex, because honestly, you need to get that knowledge into you, not only just about sex generally, but like how your preferential, nope, that doesn't make sense, how your preferences, right, are informed by your sexual experiences and how those then inform your boundaries that you either will create for yourself future or in the future, or like already have like an innate understanding of. So yeah, just don't be Akko Taco about it. Sit at the seat of sex and say, hello, Satan. Just kidding. It's not depraved or at all to do with the devil. But that is, you know, internalized Christian trauma jumping out at you. We're only at minute and 32 into this episode, and I'm already doing the most. So let's step back. Hey, welcome. Thank you for joining. Thanks for being here. I am excited that you're here because we got a doozy of an episode for you today. So first things first, summer release. Drop this and let the whole world feel it. Hey, and I'm not in the minor business. I'm going to hold it down like I'm too. Okay, sorry. Actually, no, we do not. This is actually so bizarre. ADHD will have you say one sentence and then your mind will lightning fast speed over to like a song lyric. And before you know it, you're singing it. And then before you know it, your brain's giving you like 404 error not found, like warning alerts, because you didn't realize until you started singing that it's Iggy Trashalia. And you're like, oh no, not the most problematic. Like, oof, oof. So apologies for that. I take it back. No apologies. But just, if you had to endure that, know that I stand with you. Okay, so what are we talking about today? Like, what is the juice? What is the tea? What is giving you those ooh-ah-ah moments? And it is Zombie Frog. Yeah, that's right. If you've never heard of her, don't worry. She's relatively new in the herpetologist community. So she was actually just discovered. I know, hot topic. We're bringing you literally breaking news. But quack, 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 quack. Breaking news. You are gay. No, I'm just kidding. You're not. Or maybe you are, and that's fine. But the breaking news is actually the story of the zombie frog, which was... It's a species of newly discovered frog. So it actually was discovered this month. Yes, July, I believe, at the beginning of July 2021 by a herpetologist by the name of Raphael Ernst. And this was through his PhD. He was conducting his PhD in the Amazon rainforest, specifically in Guyana, in South America. So for those of you who don't know, the Amazon rainforest is like that giant, mega, amazing rainforest. For those of you who don't know, are you kidding me, Jalen? What are you talking about? Everyone best know what the Amazon rainforest is. But maybe you don't know that it's like not, like it's not entirely Brazil's. Like it's shared by several countries in South America, including Guyana, including Peru, including Brazil. And so anyway, French Guyana, all these things. So the discovery, why I thought it was so interesting, it was interesting for a couple things. One, I love me a frog. I love me a good frog moment. I love me some amphibians because amphibians are truly that bitch. Like, evolutionarily speaking, they really have, they've out-trumped everyone. They are just, you know that audio that's like, ha 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 ha. Just laughing, because that's amphibians, that is frogs, that is salamanders, that is all of the wayward witch and aquatic terrestrial hybridos that are out here just laughing at the rest of us, because evolutionarily they were like, water, yeah, that's a cool environment, lots of resources there. Oh my gosh, but water, sometimes it's too chaotic. So land, okay, what you got going on here? Oh my gosh, land, that's wild. There's also a lot going on here. So you know what? Maybe let me just put my kids in the water. Y'all chill there. And then when you're ready, maybe come out to the land. But if not, like, you can just turn the water too. Like, that is such a smart parenting strategy, to be like, I had a safe home and then I went out and explored the world and I was able to grow and become better. But you know what? For my kids, let me start them off with the same safe home I had. And you know what? I love that. And over the years, over the centuries, over the millennium, we have what? Who? How? Salamandras. We have frogs. And we have these beautifully newly discovered species of zombie frog, which is under the genus Snapturanus, which I'm like, go off. That literally sounds like magic. Snapturanus mesomorphus and Snapturanus achyric. Oh, well, I cannot speak. You all know me in Latin. Snapturanus aduricaba. So these are like the known sort of members of the within the same genus. But this new zombie frog, right? It's giving me very like. Did y'all ever watch Pan's Labyrinth? Do you know the movie Pan's Labyrinth? Yes. Okay, good. And there's like that infamous scene with the hands, and it's like, wow, scary. But there's another scene, which I thought was, on TBH, a little bit more infamous, especially when you see the behind the scenes for how that scene was made. They actually crafted out an entire, and a giant frog. Oh, anyway, so there's this giant frog scene in Pan's Labyrinth where she has to like go into this like tunnel, then there's this giant frog, and she has to like get a key thing. Anyway, this frog is giving me that. It's very Pan's Labyrinth frog, very slimy, very like, ooh, we like living in this watery, mucky, muddy conditions. And that's the tea. They literally look exactly like the home that they live in. So the gag was, right, that there's so little known about these zombie frogs. I mean, in like public, in the public sphere of information, because we know, right, that the Amazon rainforest has upwards of like 400 different indigenous communities. So I am sure there has been some knowledge about these frogs within there. But we're going to get to that in a second. So we don't know publicly a lot about these zombie frogs, and that's because they're in really hard to access areas, and they also, right, produce, like, the way that this scientist, Ernest, was able to find them was because of, they had a very unique vocalization. So a very unique croak. I'm gonna give you an artistic rendition of the croak now. So they like heard that, and then they were like, oh my gosh, that doesn't sound like anything that I've heard before. And so apparently, as the story goes, Ernest heard the noise and immediately started digging. And then after, you know, about like 5 minutes of like digging into the mud in this like heavy rain, he was able to find this zombie frog, and they were able to find a couple specimens. And so this, let's just take a second here. Kudos to you, Ernest, for like hearing a scary noise and then immediately being like, that must be a frog. And then just digging in like the dark and the dirt and like finding this species. I love that for you. And I love that you care so much about amphibians, right? That you are willing to do this type of work. However, what I don't appreciate, Ernst, is this unilateral, very, 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 very colonial mindset that you and your wayward ass German fucking research team have just decided to uphold, which is that, oh, we found this thing and we're just going to name it whatever the fuck we want. Zombie frog. I was looking through articles about this, y'all, and I'll share them over in the show notes, but I was like, is there any reason why? I was like, what is the reason? Like, maybe, you know, it's because there's like some sort of parasitic fungus that they also found that made the frog's like nervous system shut down, but it was still alive somehow. And like, I don't know. I was trying to, I was really doing scientific gymnastics to find out why they would be naming it zombies. I was like, maybe there's some sort of parasitic insect. Maybe there's something happening where it's like, you know, why? Why would they do that? Maybe they found out that they are only eating like the brains of rodents. Like, I don't know, something, right? Something, anything. No, literally just this wayward man and his fucking research team being like, well, when I looked into the mud and I pulled it out, it kind of looked like a zombie to me. Ernest, are you serious? Girl, are you serious? You are on land. You and your German team are on land that requires buckets of sunscreen for you to exist without burning, without you becoming into tanned leather, without you turning into this taxi seat, okay? But no, you and your wayward ass team were like, yeah, zombies, this is a zombie. So you saw yourself in the frog. That's what you're telling me. You saw yourself in the frog and decided to name it after it. But this is also what's pissing me off more so about this. Not only the fact that it was named purely out of this weird aesthetic thing that this research team was like, yeah, we all agree, aesthetically, it looks like a zombie. That is one and done. I can get behind that, maybe, in some setting. But it's the fact that y'all are this predominantly white research team coming in, right, to South America, specifically into Guyana, and then with your full chest and long, long throat saying, one, this was discovered. Two, we are gonna name it. Three, that name is not gonna give any reference to the location, to the peoples that live here, to the knowledge that has been stolen or lost. Like, there is just, it's just so white. It's just so very colonial. It's just giving me very Christopher Columbus boots, okay? It's giving me very Jon Snow in the story of Pocahontas, no, okay? Because that's what I'm saying right now. Sorry, that may have been actually a little bit insensitive, but you'll get what I mean, right? It's this idea that you as a researcher felt with all your importance and all your education that you have the power and the right to go about naming this thing with absolutely no nuance, with absolutely no consideration. Just entirely, purely self-serving, connected to yourself. And that right there is like, I'm like, Y'all, if you saw what the conversation was happening over on Instagram earlier this week, you would have clocked. I was like, I'm over it. I'm done. I'm done with these common names ushered out by wayward white men who just be out here being like, literally no awareness about the violence that they're causing. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna name this thing after the Romani people because, you know, I see these caterpillars, they travel from the leaves down to the bark and then they're resting. They're like lazy, so like hashtag gypsy moth. And I should have put a trigger warning that there was gonna be a racial slur there, but if you're a Romani, no, I don't mean that as a, I don't use the G term and I don't like to say it, but I think a lot of people still have a misconception about hearing that term because it's so widely popularized and used. And I think there's even a show on Netflix with the name. It's like, it's wild. So I really need y'all to like just clock the ways in which even this very subversive, right, form of colonialism and white supremacy is still prevalent today. It's still happening, jumping out of the woodwork today, July 2021. Out here with all of the Google searches, with all the black squares posted, with all of the people jumping out of their screens and into your psyche to be like, hey, no, don't build your pipelines here. Hey, no, listen to us here. Hey, no. Oh, look, wildfires. Well, that's what happens when you strip indigenous people from the land who are fire stewards and actually use indigenous fire practices to manage forests. But no, then we have fire suppression and then bam, out of here. And this is my ADHD going way out of control and double time, over speed, over time right now. But this is the ways in which this violence gets perpetuated and is connected in these very subtle ways as if, oh, I'm just going to name a frog that I just happened to find. And yeah, some of you listening will be like, okay, you're like, you've gone too far into this. But it's like, it starts with the naming of animals. And then it starts with the methodologies used in your research where they're entirely extractive in and of itself. There's no community-based aspect to it with the land as stewards of that land, as people who are coming in and extracting knowledge, extracting data. Do you give back? Is there anything reciprocal or is it only taking? Do you have any connection to the stewards, the people who are at the indigenous communities who are actually there dependent on the land, or are you just extracting? These are the ways that I'm talking about, right? Just coming in, setting up your flag, saying I made it to the moon and walking the fuck away, bitch. No. So that is our animal of the week. Snap Tyrannus. Hey, welcome to the internet and to the world of Googleable frogs. You are now saved prime time right on my screen. You're going to be a screensaver for a little bit because honestly, they're quite adorbs. And if you ask me, it's not giving zombie. She's not giving zombie. Mama, no. She's giving me very Muppet. She's giving me very like that vibe, you know, very like my neck is in my shoulders and I have like a good overbite and I'm like, what is she really giving me? She's giving me very like Monsters, Inc., but not a monster, you know, like in a fun way, like Pixar. Okay, very that. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and share images of the frogs as well as, like, you know, the articles in the show notes for today's episode. But we are going to jump now into 626 for the week, which is on a similar thread. As you know, we are like just going straight into 626 now. And as I said, of season one, we had all the jingles. Now we've moved on. Lovely. Love that for us. We said growth. So this week's 626, we're going to be talking about, and by we, the proverbial we, I'm going to be talking me. I'm talking about it. And I'm going to be talking about, you guessed it, amphibians, but not frogs per se. The focus of this week is just general amphibians and then with like a tie to salamanders. Now you're like, bitch, why are you talking so much about amphibians? Like what's the gagaroni? Like why is it why do you care? And I care first and foremost because amphibians are like really fucking cool. As you know, I was talking about how they've evolutionary just like dummied the game. They've just at the top. They're like, yeah, we got it. But unfortunately, because of wayward species that they share a planet with, humans, right, doing higgy-huggle with the climate, then, oh, lovely, dovely moments, they are now stressed Betty Boots. And so amphibians globally are the most threatened and at risk class of species that we share this planet with when it comes to environmental destruction, when it comes to seasonal changes, when it comes to entire climatic envelopes shifting, when it comes to just the pressures that climate change is putting on these communities. It's really, it's not the moment for them. They are having a really hard time. And so amphibian decline is something that we're seeing like across the board. And I'll go, maybe I'll share some of like some papers you can read about that. Like there's been actually a lot of global work done that has across the neotropics to really quantify shifts in amphibian population sizes, and that's across taxa. And actually, there's a really cool website that actually lets you visualize the changes, even by species, which is really cool. So I'll go ahead and share that in the show notes. But which again, you can find that over on Patreon, patreon.com/hauntingj. But the thing is, right, something that I think that amphibians, unfortunately, don't really get a lot of love. Like frogs and toads, kind of, they can. But typically speaking, like amphibians, like salamanders, axolotls, like all these different kind of like amphibians that we share space with, they don't get a good rap. And if they do, it's very like, no, okay, actually, let's be specific. They don't get a good rap. If they do get any media coverage at all, they're the villain, right? And if we look, and if they aren't the villain, they're like some weird, obscure character that you don't get to fucking connect with, right? A Pan's Labyrinth, the villain frog who was hoarding the key, didn't get to really connect with that. You have Monsters, Inc., which Randall, based off of a salamander, was the villain. And I'm like, again, those are only two examples. I can't go through all of human history right now and tell you all the ways in which amphibians are vilified and or not cared about. But as a whole, they don't really get good coverage. And so today I wanted to take a moment and be like, okay, let's paint amphibians in a new light. Literally, because that is the topic of today's paper, is the bioluminescence of amphibians. You heard that right. So salamanders and other amphibians are able to glow. That's correct, with biofluorescence. So you're like, girl, what the fuck is biofluorescence? So if you don't know, biofluorescence is, I really need to stop saying, if you don't know, because you know what, if you don't know, that's fine. And I just am going to be telling you anyway. So, but biofluorescence is the absorption of electromagnetic radiation, so light, at one wavelength, followed by its re-emission at a lower energy and longer wavelength by living organisms. So it's essentially, I'm like taking in light and then I'm re-emitting it out at like this lower kind of pulsey moment, giving you a dimmer, richer source of light. It's not giving you sunshine, it's giving you glowworm. So that's kind of like a little intro into what the fuck is biofluorescence? Like, what does that even mean, right? And many studies have actually found that biofluorescence, well, I should say this, that a lot of the research that's out there, right, is on biofluorescence is about marine animals, so cnidarians, cartilaginous and rafin fishes, right? Those are kind of like the main big papers that have a lot to do with biofluorescence. But comparatively, right, when you look at the order of tetrapods, when you look at amphibia more generally, right, there hasn't been a lot of research into biofluorescence. And so this paper, which is actually titled Salamanders and Other Amphibians Are Aglow with Biofluorescence, was written by Jennifer Lamb and Matthew Davis, and it was published in February 2020 in Scientific Reports, which is, you know, classic scientific journal, but I'm sure you'll be able to find it in anywhere. Just Google, like, or Google the DOI, or you just head on over to Patreon and it'll be linked there. So this paper is really cool. There's a lot, if I'm being honest, like, I don't really physics isn't my forte. I understand it and I think it's cool, but I'm not like a physicist and I'm not out here being like, yes, and the energy wavelengths and then this and then that. And then you have the eye and you have the rods and you have the green rod. Like they went into like these different anatomy aspects of salamanders. And let's talk about it, right? Because the paper went into kind of explaining like, why is it that we would even have these biofluorescence, like with why is biofluorescence even a thing that we're seeing within amphibias, be it within the order, sorry, of amphibia. So that's salamanders, that's things like the I don't want to call them like skinks, but they kind of look like snakes, but they have like two little front arms, frogs, right? And so what the paper was essentially able to find is that the biofluorescent light that is emitted by salamanders and frogs and caecilians, this light is, it comes out as like green to like greenish yellow. So that's the first and foremost. And they were able to do this through a tool called a flame spectrometer, which was able to filter the light through a yellow long pass filter, which was about 5 nanometers. And what they were essentially able to see was all of these different species showcasing a very, very prominent biofluorescence. And if you've never seen biofluorescence within the order of amphibia, like if you've never seen glow-in-the-dark salamanders, I'll go ahead and share also, because they have a really cool image of like all of the different species that they were able to take photos of, both like in color and in the biofluorescence, like with their special imaging. And so you can go ahead and check out that photo over on the Patreon. But it's absolutely really cool, because what I really like about this is that the biofluorescence doesn't actually impede on like the coloration or the pattern, I should say, of the different salamanders and the frogs, right, across the different species that they were able to photograph. And so they observed more so this biofluorescence was actually like highlighting the different morphological features and the different like patterns and designs that was on the skin. And it just really looks very, very cool. Like I don't know if I have like a fun sciencey way of saying that, but for me it was just giving me like very magical, and I was like, this is absolutely insane to me. Again, not in an ableist way, but like in a way that's just like, that is so hard for me to comprehend. Like, and this is the gag too, is that from this research they were actually able to confirm, let me actually pull up the note here. So when examined in the context of a taxonomically robust hypothesis of evolutionary relationships for amphibians, they found that fluorescence, the presence, right, of fluorescence isn't restricted to a particular lineage of salamanders, but that it was actually likely present throughout Caudata, which is like the Latin name for the order of salamander. And the presence of fluorescence was found in a variety of lineages. So that includes the Apoda, so that's the caecilians, that's Anuras also, so that's frogs, the Cryptobranchidae, so giant salamanders, the Sirenidae, so that's sirens, right? You have the Protidae, mud puppies, the Amphiumidae, so that's the Amphiumas. You also have the Plethodontidae, so those are the lungless salamanders. So as you can see, a wide range, just an entire suite, you could say, of amphibians that are just capable of this biofluorescence, right? And Gagatrandramama is why? Why in the world do you need to have all of the cheat codes? You have literally everything. You said, I want to breathe water. Done. I want to breathe air. Done. I want to live in water. Done. I want to live on land. Done. I want to be able to climb, but I also want to be able to swim fast. And I also want to be able to glow in the goddamn dark. And this is the thing that we actually need to clarify here on this podcast. Biofluorescence isn't necessarily glowing in the dark, but what it means is that the presence of UV light, ultraviolet light, actually then results in this biofluorescence. So UV light, as you know, like if you watch CSI Miami or you any of those drama shows, you know, back when you were like a kid and you're like, I'm not watching Family Channel anymore. No more Disney. I'm on to crime. And you watch like Criminal Minds and yeah, Law and Order. Anyway, all those shows, they would be like squirt, 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 UV light, purple moment. And that's like just purely UV light. But y'all, you need to know that like the sun also produces ultraviolet light, like on a day-to-day basis, literally. So there is, right, the potential for that ultraviolet radiation to then result in biofluorescence. Now, Gagaroni, who's out here looking in ultraviolet wavelengths? Well, we know that some species have the ability. They have the eye structure in order to be able to catch ultraviolet light or be able to see that side of the light spectrum. And so animals like this include deer, right? Also, hawks are capable of doing this. And I'm not to say that, like, deers are running through the forest looking at sparkly ass like frogs, or that hawks are like flying in the sky and they're like, oh my gosh, what is that shimmering snaky looking thing? But it's this ability, right, to actually pick up that ultraviolet spectrum and how that then will allow these animals to have a higher sensitivity visually to the biofluorescence that amphibians produce. So we need to actually maybe take two steps back, because we're like, but what about the perception of biofluorescence in the first place? Like, can that even happen? Can most people, would I be able to see that? Can I just like cut my hands around a frog and will it glow in the dark? The answer is no, right? Because the perception of biofluorescent light, it one depends on the sensitivity of the eye, so like of the observer. It also requires you to have rod photoreceptors in the retina. So those play a key role in vision during low light conditions, such as, you know, those that happen during twilight or during dusk, right? And so vertebrates like salamanders, frogs, chelicerans, right? They do have these like red rods, which help maximize their sensitivity to green light. And the theory then is that this theory is saying that biofluorescence is happening, or it's a way that these amphibians are actually able to be more visually sensitive to one another, right? So it actually helps with the visibility and the identification of each other in these low light conditions because of these red rod photoreceptors that help maximize, right, their sensitivity to green light. So being like, oh my gosh, I can see that mark is over there growing, like glowing green. So maybe this is like a pretty good spot. If Mark's here, oh my gosh, Susan's over there. And oh, is that Doug over there? Okay, it's like literally 3 a.m. I can barely see. But if y'all are around here just chilling, I guess maybe this is like a safe space for me. Maybe I could chill too. So that could be like one of the reasons. But the paper actually does do a really good job at breaking down a lot of the potentials, right, for why we even have this biofluorescence phenomena evolved within the species of amphibians, right? But I'm not gonna go through all of them. There is one other thing that I thought that would be really interesting to bring up. I'll bring up one more, which is that biofluorescence may function for both intra and interspecific communication, right? So that's communication both like within their own species, within their own communities, within the own amphibians, but then also as a form of communication with other species, right? So for example, in flying squirrels, fluorescence is first and foremost a thing that flying squirrels are capable of showing fluorescence, and it's hypothesized to aid in camouflaging against a backdrop of lichens that emit similar fluorescent spectrum. So what does that mean? It's essentially flying squirrels, they have the color pattern of their fur that we can see within the spectrum of light that we can see. But we have to understand that we're not a hawk flying in the sky who is capable of seeing in that infrared spectrum. Sorry, not in the infrared, in the ultraviolet. And so if I'm a hawk and I'm looking around, oh, I'm getting ultraviolet signals, and the lichen that I'm looking at is giving off a signal, and then, oh, Gagaroni, is that it's truly a flying squirrel. It's just that the flying squirrel's fluorescence is giving off a similar signal to lichen. So we have ultraviolet cryptic camouflage. We have camouflage through the manipulation of light. This is why I fucking love animals, y'all, and looking at the world of wildlife, because the things that are literally happening with outside of our field of vision, outside of our ability to even visualize and comprehend, but those are still determining the interactions that we're then able to watch and see behaviorally. Mama, Gagaroni. How many invisible things are happening that are influencing the physical things that we then are trying to interpret? You know, it gives me all the excitement. I'm like, for real. There truly be a world of invisibility, of a truly invisible world of things that we cannot access, but we're able to see the sort of shadow, the sort of after effect of, right, the after image of. And that's very much, this is very much now a tangent moment, but it's very much how I feel about energies, about spirituality, about just life generally, right, is that so often we're trying to be like, oh my gosh, I need to see everything. Oh my gosh, I need to see my career path. Oh my gosh, I need to be able to see this. I need to be able to see through this. I need to be able to do this XYZ in order to get my goals. Mama, you are not always going to be in the best vantage point to see the things that you need to reach or to access or to understand. Sometimes the vantage point that you're in, you're not capable of seeing that bioflorescence, mama. You need to adjust the angle that you are seeing it from. Remember last week when we were talking about cuttlefishes and how when you're looking at iridophores or those types of cells that refract light in different ways, and how when you adjust, if you look at it straight down, oh, it looks red. But you look at it from the angle, oh, it looks blue. Mama, this is what we're talking about generally in life. You're not always going to have the vantage point or the capacity or the ability to see everything that is happening around you that is working either in your favor or against you. But ultimately, that isn't a negative, right? We have to be confident and comfortable with the fact that there are always going to be aspects of our reality that we cannot tune into directly, but are still influencing and are working to push us to that next place, right? In our growth, in our learning, in our understanding of the world, each other, and ourselves. Wow, that got mad introspective, and this isn't even tarot card reading. So if you like the little bit of a moment, you know what to do. Raccoon Club members, you'll get tarot card readings every month where we get a little bit more introspective like that. But on Zaboo Foolish, we just try to keep it to the animales. That being said, we are now going to jump into our what's the sitch for this week. I'll go ahead again, everything you've heard of so far, like from the zombie frog to this paper to bioflorescence, all that good. You can find it over on the Patreon, which I love. One of the most amazing ways you can support me and this podcast. And another one is through sponsors. So we're actually going to hear a little bit of word. We're gonna jump right back after a word from this week's show sponsor. This week's show sponsor is brought to you by Martin Bunzel, the author and creator of the wondrous new book, Thinking While Walking. Yep, you heard it here right. Thinking While Walking is a marvelous read for anyone who loves nature, anyone who loves the outdoors, or anyone who likes to experience life and sometimes wants to reflect on those experiences. And Martin does an incredible job at not only outlining, you know, some of those reflections that we all share, but how those reflections are then tied more specifically to climate change, to the land, and to our understanding of ecology, biology, and nature more generally. And if this sounds like your cup of tea, well, you know what to do. Head on over to the show notes and drop that link. Yes, Hot Topic in your web browser. That's it. You just have to drop the link into your browser and it will take you to Martin Bunzel's website where you can order his book now. It's like $5 if you want the online version. I think it's like only $9 if you want the hard copy. And for me personally, I think the term is bibliophile. Like, I love books. I love like holding them. I love the physical things of them. Like, I love like writing like physical notes. Like, y'all, if you could see my desk right now, it's just sticky notes and notepads galore. So that's me. If you are a you know, materials kind of girl, then the hard copy's for you. But otherwise, just get yourself the online version, you know, $5. It's like one Starbucks drink. Unless you live in New York, then that's one Starbucks straw. So I hope that, yeah, y'all check it out, give it a read. And I want to big ups Professor Bunzo, big ups Martin for being this week's show sponsor. Really appreciate it. And it's because of sponsorships like this that the show was able to keep going. So let's get back into the goodies for today's episode.
So what's the cinch?
Okay, full disclosure, and this is why this episode is coming out also a little bit late. So I started recording this episode 12 hours ago. And it's been like a little bit of a time, and then I ended up having to like go and like leave and do a thing and then come back. And then my computer wasn't working, and then all this drama, and then I had to go, and it was my friend's birthday, so I had to like go pop off there. Anyway, so now I'm coming back, and I had initially wanted to talk about one thing for What's the Sitch, which maybe I'll get into later, but I really want to, I don't know, maybe this is a bit selfish of me, but then again, it is my fucking podcast, so hi, hello. This concept of like self-fulfilling prophecies, like, and that could mean a variety of things, right, for different people, right? So for me, it could be, like, this idea that if I am, like, you know, good enough, or if I'm attractive enough, or if I look good enough, then that'll mean, like, I have, like, earned the love that I am so desperately, like, seeking out in people. And it could be, like, similarly in other people, right? Maybe the way that a self-fulfilling prophecy comes out for you is, like, you constantly like are overly sexual with people as a way of controlling how you yourself are sexualized, or maybe you are the first person to start pushing people away so that when they do inevitably like leave you or leave your immediate sphere of interaction, you can be like, haha, knew it all along, you've kind of like expected the worst. And so I think that we being me and you listening, we have our own self-fulfilling prophecies that whether we acknowledge it or not, we are actively participating in to our detriment, right? And how did this come out for me today? Well, Gagaroni is, and I've done this so many times, I'm just such a hopeless romantic that I truly be out here in these streets being like, yes, love is just around the corner. And then I look around the corner and it's not love, but because I looked around the corner, well, they're like a fucking baby duck trying to imprint on its mother so that it can get instinctive skills. I just be like, oh my gosh, are you love? And then lo and behold, like XYZ amount of time into the relationship, be it the friendship, be it this misconstrued idea of romance, and then bam, reality done slaps you in the face. And you're like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is why you cannot be jumping so freely into these pools of self-fulfilling prophecies, because honestly, it'll have you doing all of the mental gymnastics. It'll have you doing all of the exhaustion, right? To justify why you are doing something that you know is not aligned with how you see yourself, how you see other people, advice that you would give other people. So like, yeah, something, if you needed to hear this, because I needed to tell myself this in this moment right now here today, is like, you are incredibly powerful and you don't have to settle for know which one. And that means that you literally, you do not have to be out here with this scarcity mindset of like, you will never be loved, you will never get into a relationship, you'll never get the, like, you are only get the crumbs or whatever. Like, that's not the case. You actually can go for things that you not only want, but that you are like, you're actively looking for in a relationship or in a person. You don't ever have to settle. So just like, take that as it will. If you're in a relationship right now, or if you're not in a relationship right now, these are the words you need to hear. I hope they reach you. Because if you are in relationship, be it a friendship, even be it a romantic relationship, be it a familiar relationship, right? And the individual on the opposite side of that relationship is consistently letting you down or disappointing you, You don't have to continue to create an image of them in your head that works with the fantasy, that makes the relationship continue at work or palatable or, you know, to reduce friction, you shouldn't be sacrificing your own ideals or your own expectations of someone that you want to be in relationship with. So that's like a very much a tangential tangent moment. Because I feel like that needed to be said and that needed to be shared. Wow, this episode really did get into like some of the feels for y'all. But again, this isn't a tarot reading. This is not the Raccoon Club. So apologies for that. Again, but not sorry. I do remember. Yeah, the theme of today is not saying sorry. I'm not sorry for giving you the goodies. That being said, I am apologizing because normally What's the Sitch is a section of this podcast where we unpack in a wildlife conflict or just like some sort of conflict in general. It could be interspecific, it could be interspecific, right? And there are a variety of different conflicts that we've unpacked on this episode, either between humans and animals and animals and animals, what have you. So I want to apologize in the sense that like I haven't even given you the ooh-ah-ah when it comes to what we're going to be talking about for What's the Sitch today. And that is, yeah, you guessed it. It's the coyote attacks in Stanley Park. So a couple interesting developments. First and foremost, I actually, someone I went to school with actually ended up reaching out to me. And we had a conversation about how this conflict is unfolding. And they were of the mind of, like, pro-humans, like, you know, people are getting injured, and therefore we have to take direct action. And so for me, what really came, so I, to be honest, y'all, something I do struggle with is, like, empathy. I do, like, I feel like that's an emotion I can feel, and it's an emotion I can do, and, like, I can inhabit, but when it comes to, like, things that I feel very passionately about and very strongly about, like, wildlife, like to like ask me to extend my empathy when the balance of power is so uneven, it's just very like, for me, I'm like, I can extend my empathy to the humans, sure, but also collectively we're out here like feeding these coyotes, we're out here encroaching on what little natural habitat they do have, we're out here just like slicing and dicing members of their communities. But here we are playing, again, not playing the victim, because I need to extend empathy. I need to practice that more. And that people who have been injured by coyotes, they are victims. That is a fact. That is a reality. And that is something that I truly do need to think about more, right? Is this human aspect of conflicts, right? And of confrontation. And just because I maybe understand the situation with a bit more nuance, doesn't mean I can't extend, right, my compassion to the individuals who have actually been harmed as a result of this conflict. So if you're listening to this podcast and you are one of the people who were trying to feed a coyote in Stanley Park and got bit, or one of the people who was running near one of the known locations that they have been active at this past couple of weeks and got chased or got bit, I am very sorry that you experienced pain and that's something that you had to endure. However, actually not however, I take out the however, we edit that out, we'll just leave it at that, period, point blank, done. I also feel extremely frustrated because of how this coyote population is being managed. So again, my friend who actually works with the conservation service officer, right, has said that like apparently the officers, like, they're like really like beat up about this, like they really didn't want to euthanize them, and their justification being like, well, relocation rarely works. And I immediately clapped back in the conversation because I was like, well, did you try at all? Because I'm like, I'm sorry. From what I've heard, your first response with these coyotes was euthanization. It wasn't relocation. So for you to sit upon a decision-making tower and say, well, relocation isn't the decision we can make effectively, it's not that I don't believe you. Like, I'm not saying you have to show me receipts, but I mean, show me fucking receipts in this case. Like, What animals have you relocated? Is there a public record? Is there a record of those that have you relocated that have been successful versus that haven't been successful? Because if we want to talk about how, oh, this wasn't a decision we could make, oh, how we couldn't be relocating, it's not successful. What has been successful for you as a conservation office service? What has been successful for you? Oh, right, yes, gag. It's all private. Oh, gag, right. The records aren't kept. Oh, gag, right. Yes, you haven't relocated. So don't come to me with this, what if, who, what's, what have you, okay? And you're like, Jalen, or you're like, Jay, okay, because don't call me Jalen. You're like, why are you so heated about this? And it's because there's been more development, y'all. So remember last week, I told you that four had been captured and euthanized. So as of this week, so this is Friday, but technically now it's like 1 a.m. that I'm finishing this recording, so it's technically this Saturday. So this was 3 days ago now. Another person got attacked. Yeah, so the BC Conservation Office Service says it's investigating another coyote attack in Stanley Park that happened on Thursday, the 22nd of July. And this is after euthanizing, right, those four aggressive coyotes. So the latest incident happened around like 9:30 p.m. at night. And it was actually on Wednesday, but it was reported on Thursday. And a woman was jogging along the seawall. So if you've gone onto the Patreon and gone to the extra content, you would have seen that map I shared last week about like sort of the park closure. And on that map, you can see there's like a thin line that outlines the whole park. So that is what's called the seawall. And it's like this area that you could like, it's just essentially a border for this big park that you can like run and jog along or bike along. And so this woman was jogging along the seawall, and then she was bitten on the leg. And she suffered minor injuries from the attack. So the conservation officer was then like, okay, work. Let's start patrolling the area again. They started patrolling the park in hopes of locating that specific coyote that attacked the woman. They are literally just continuing the search for another week. So after, again, euthanizing four, caught and killed four, they're like, got it. Okay, we got to get another one. We got to just go and kill another one. So this is what I'm really frustrated by, is because so much of the decisions that are being made are happening without the full suite of information, right? So a report, actually, one of the reporters, I think it was from CBC or City TV, actually, they found, they had an interview with the officer, and he was like, yeah, we believe that there are as many as like maybe six coyotes that have been involved in these like recent attacks, but we don't know for sure. Because again, harking it back to season one, when I was talking to you about the work that I'm doing in the city of Vancouver, no Canadian municipality knows the distribution, the population, or the behavioral characteristics of any mesopredator species. Yeah, you heard that correct. Raccoons, coyotes, possums, skunks. We have no accessible population data, no studies, no urban ecology has ever been done on a massive scale across any of our municipalities. And so that right there in and of itself gags me. How can you be out here doing any which sort of management with species and you don't even have knowledge? You don't even know how many total are living in the park. What if it's just this one population of six coyotes? And this is the thing too, I was talking about with my friend, that I was like, this is what has me super worried about this, is that this population of coyotes is incredible, not only because of their ability to get to Stanley Park, to defend their territory, to establish their range, but then also, morphologically speaking, they are the darkest colored coyotes I have ever seen in the city. Every coyote that I've ever photographed in the city of Vancouver has been fairly tan or dark brown at its darkest. These coyotes in Stanley Park are near black in their fur color, which I'm assuming, right, is adding to their the sort of cryptic nature of their movement. It actually aids in their ability to move not only through Stanley Park, but potentially moving through the city to get to Stanley Park in that way because of this darker colored phenotype. And so for me, this is super concerning, because not only do you have a potentially more stealthy, more sleuthier sub, like, I guess, little group of coyotes, but we're then going and killing them all? Like, you're telling me that we actually have the potential, right, to coexist with a full-on meso-predator that is cryptic in its nature, that is actually more stealthy than the rest of its cohort, and therefore would maybe be the best possible suited predator to be sharing a giant park with. But no, y'all said murder. And this is the thing, too, is like, so people are quick to jump to be like, this isn't murder. It's euthanization. We have to do this. People are getting injured. And I'm like, no. And again, I need to extend empathy because it's like, do I need a human to die in order for me to then be like, okay, well then, yeah, maybe something needs to happen. But no, if I'm being genuine, I don't think, given the information we have accessible to us now, given the amount of people in the city alone, right, that have either worked with coyotes or work within the field of zoology, work within the field of biology alone, to suggest to me that euthanization is the best strategy across the board for every single one of these instances, that's just a hard, I'm not buying that. I'm not buying that meal. I'm not taking it to the checkout. I'm sorry. I'm looking at it twice and I'm putting it back on the shelf. I'm sorry. Again, I'm not sorry because I don't believe it. Anyway, so super frustrating. And again, I'm not into victim blaming. This is not what I'm doing here on this podcast. But I think that there is a special level of arrogance that comes into play when you, as a human who shares a space with these meso-predators, hears about several attacks, 4 killings, and the threat, right, of further conflict in this space as they're looking for these coyotes, and you decide, yeah, I'm going to go for a jog. Yeah, after work, I'm going to go for a quick jog. Through the drama, through the chaos, I'm going to go for a quick jog. And again, this is not to victim blame the person. We should be allowed as humans to jog in our cities. I fully do believe that. I also believe that during moments of heightened human-wildlife conflict, maybe we should walk with a little bit more grace, with a little bit more consideration for who's actually going to be bearing the brunt of that conflict if you, as an entity entering into that space, escalate it, right? So if you know, for example, that a camping area has been pretty active with bears, and you're like, okay, work, well, I'm going to go there anyway. You as a human know how human society is working in your favor, right? And so this idea that, oh, well, this is just some harmless act, I'm just jogging. No, you're walking with it, even if you're not consciously aware of the potential harm, right? You know that you are a part of a community, the human community, that is going to ride with you over a coyote, over a bear, over any which way predator, especially an animal that they can vilify. So, again, we're not victim blaming here, but just clock the ways in which you yourself may be making decisions that are fully rooted in that privilege of human community, right? And being like, I'm going to go and do this action. I'm going to go and enter this space. I'm going to go and do this thing because I fully know that I'm supported by other humans if anything were to happen. So we're gonna quickly wrap it up here because while there has been another coyote attack in Stanley Park this week, and I'm gonna continue to update y'all as the story progresses because I'm working with the Stanley Park Ecological Society right now, and we're developing some programming for the fall, and I'm actually also working with I'm not working with her, but I'm in contact with Kristen Walker, who is a professor at the University of British Columbia, who's doing camera track work in Stanley Park with the coyote population. So I would really, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to do some reaching out both to the Stanley Park Ecological Society and to Kristen Walker, see if we can get some data on what their initial estimates are for the total population size of coyotes in the park. And then we can start to actually see, and we can start to have a real conversation on this podcast on what the actual damage is to the overall population because of these 4 euthanizations, right? And something that I'm also going to try and get for y'all is some more data around the euthanizations, like the gender, the age, right? I think that these things are really important because if we're taking, for example, the oldest, the smartest, and the most reproductively capable members of their population, what does that leave? What does that leave? So I'm going to be doing a little bit more sleuthing. I'm going to pop on my Nancy Drew hat. Nancy who? Yeah, I guess I don't need to be quoting Nancy Drew on this podcast, but you heard it here first. So you can expect more updates on that. But yeah, the thing that I wanted to wrap it to is the fact that Vancouver is not the only city that is dealing with aggressive coyote attacks. So nearly every city in North America has a population of urban coyotes. And the recent attacks in Stanley Park have highlighted like sort of what can happen if and when they get too acclimated to humans, right? Too comfortable with humans. So I'm going to tell you all really quickly about Colleen Cassidy St. Clair. So she's a biological scientist and professor at the University of Alberta. And she also has a podcast. It's called Tuesday's Big Story Podcast. And she told the host of the podcast, who I believe the host's name is Jordan Rawlings. Anyway, she told the host that there's been an increased number of coyotes in urban reports across the continent over the last two decades, right? And so while we're talking about this, like Stanley Park, oh my gosh, like this is wild. Like we need to note that coyote spottings have been popping off in places, in cities like Halifax, in Calgary, right, in Phoenix, and Yellowknife. Like, bare places across the continent have been increasing in the coyote presence, the coyote population overall size, and the, I guess you could say, the scale of their boldness and acclimatization. Wow, we struggled through that word. Acclimatization to humans. And this is, I feel like this is a pretty good place to leave y'all. I'll go, if you like what you heard, you want to hear maybe a little bit more, just want to like connect a bit more, I'll go ahead and share that over on the show notes. Usually I pop them directly after the episode, but it's late. So I'll get the show notes ready this weekend and they'll be ready either by Sunday or Monday. So you can have a little check out there for the sources, for the extra content, get your life. But as always, you know, just you being here every week is a support in and of itself. I'm a big fan of this type of engagement because it really helps me for some of my more back-end goals that I'm working with when it comes to content production with some bigger name companies that's in the works. So I'm not going to give you all the goodies. But yeah, there are some things that I'm putting in the works on the back end. And so having these numbers, having your engagement, having your participation in the podcast is really helpful. And it's really important and I really value it. And just know that you don't like always have to be out here like leaving me reviews. But if you do, like that is also really appreciated, definitely, especially on Apple Podcasts. That's mainly where the reviews matter. But definitely even like on Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts and you're capable of giving a review, I'm extremely thankful for that. If you want to just connect outside of the podcast, head on over to Instagram. I have, you know, a wide variety of content shared there so my handle's at jaunting.j. And similarly with the show notes and the Patreon, it's patreon.com/jauntingj. And that's been this week's episode. Next week, I know. Y'all have been sending in me the letters. You have been sending me in letters. And so I appreciate that. And I'm going to read out some of the really exciting ones on next week's episode. So if you've sent in a letter, know that I've seen it. I'm going to be reading it out. And if you haven't sent me any wildlife interactions or any stories yet, you have another week. Get those letters in. You can send them over to jaunting.j@gmail.com. All right. This has been Zabuma Foolish, episode 15 with your host, Jay. Pronouns they, them. We'll catch you later. Unless you're a coyote, I hope you're running free and wild and never caught. Okay, bye. Jay.